Hello and welcome to iVow.
I'm Jenny Prisk and your host for the interviews with the three writers who documented the lives of women peacemakers who lived and studied at the University of San Diego Peace and Justice Institute in 2015. Documenting women's stories is a powerful and provocative undertaking that disrupts the conventional practice of highlighting male leaders. Stories where women are the protagonists offer understanding of the complexities of conflict, exposition of gender discrepancies, and potential avenues for transformation. In 2015, iVow interviewed the four women peacemakers. To learn more about the women, you can visit sandiego.edu. Now we have the opportunity to hear from the women who wrote their stories. For 10 weeks, they were completely engaged with the peacemakers, inviting responses to questions that drew passion, pain, and peace-building solutions from the women. It's my pleasure to be speaking with Maggie Thatch, who profiled Glenda Vilskit of South Africa. Maggie Thatch is a former sports journalist. As a college sports reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune in Utah, she became an award-winning journalist. Today, her writing revolves around immigration, assimilation, and identity. She has a master's in fine arts in creative nonfiction from the University of California, Riverside, and currently she's working on a memoir about teaching English in South Korea. Maggie, thank you for joining us.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
It's been several months since you worked alongside Glenda. In 1995, she was appointed by former President Nelson Mandela to serve as a commissioner on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Please tell us about her and her work as a human rights activist in South Africa.
I feel this is such a big question. It's hard to encapsulate everything that Glenda is in just a few sentences. I think the first few things that come to mind, and it seems like this word is too small to describe what she does, but she's a caregiver. She is amazing in that she finds a humanity in every person. She is very gracious in bringing you into her life and her experience, and I think that is why our relationship was so special. You know, I'm not new to the interviewing process. I was a journalist before, and I got so much out of this experience because she let me in so much. It's really hard to describe Glenda in just a few words, but those are the first things that come to mind.
Well, they're very special things that come to mind, and we appreciate hearing them. You worked together very closely for 10 weeks, and when you began, you were complete strangers. So now you probably know more about her than even her closest friends do, and you've alluded to that. So can you talk to us about how that relationship established and how it evolved and your writing process for Glenda?
I felt like we were able to form a very special bond, but I understood that my responsibility was to tell her story, and I took that responsibility very seriously. You know, there were times where I was emotional, and I see Glenda as like an aunt or a mom. I care about her that much. But I also understood that I needed to do a job and I needed to have that professional separation. That was very cognizant of that. But I also think we were able to establish a relationship because I wanted her to know that I was there for her. I was there to listen to her. I was very eager to show her that I did research on South Africa. I mean, I think growing up, we don't have a lot of context about South African history. I think I was conflating a lot with 1960s civil rights, and she would have to say, "Maggie, stop. that's not what we're talking about." And I would have to go back, do research, come back and say, "Okay, now I see the difference. Is this right?" So she was just very gracious in letting me make mistakes, for one, but also helping me see her story through her eyes. And I really appreciated that. It wasn't just the process of me showing her that she could trust me, but the other way around as well. And she really let me in.
And it sounds as though that trust built very well. in the shortest possible way, and I know this can be challenging, can you describe some of those issues that she was working on as part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
I think what really struck me was that the fact that both of us have this tendency to root for the underdog. I mean, as a sports writer, the parallel there is clear. But for Glenda, and being a commissioner on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, she rooted for the underdog too. She looked for people who were overlooked. She looked for people who were silenced. She looked for people who were suffering in isolation. And I think it's that ability to seek the people who need it most is what makes her so unique as a human rights activist. And I think that she's doing her part in little ways. And I don't mean little in a condescending way at all, but it's those little things that bring the big things together. Mm-hmm. I think that she was very good at that.
Women have a different approach to peace building than our counterparts. How do you think she gained traction and overcame some dangerous situations, some very challenging situations, and yet was able to move forward?
I think that she really surprised people in terms of physicality. So what I mean by that is that she's very short, kind of a petite woman, mm-hmm. but she was so fiery. Her physical dimensions could not contain her desire, her passion for justice. I can think of, off the top of my head, a few instances of when she put herself in danger because she just saw an injustice. There was this one moment I wrote about where she saw a farmer about to hit a young black man with a shambok, which is like a whip. It's one of the most medieval punishments that was perpetrated during apartheid. And this was after apartheid, just kind of an old farmer stuck in his old ways. And he was about to bring the shambok down on this young man. Glenda was across the street, saw this, went across the street, put her arm up to stop it from happening. And she asked the farmer, looked straight in his face, no fear. This is what I love about Glenda, is that people expect kind of a small, quiet woman. She looked straight in his face and said, "What did this young man do to deserve this?" And the farmer said something like, "What was I supposed to do? He was leaning on a car." So she just cannot stand injustice. And she will fight with every fiber in her being, no matter how small she may be, to stand up against it. She will not go down quietly. And that's what I really thought was paradoxical about her. She's just this, she seems like this tiny woman. A lot of people underestimated her, thought that she wasn't going to have a big impact, but she did. And so that's what I really appreciated about
her. And just to complete the story, did she stop the farmer?
She did. She did. I think she shamed him. I think she shamed him into, he could hear out loud what he was doing for such a small offense. He was going to use this weapon. And I think that he just walked away. Mm-hmm. And she stopped that.
So you heard stories of severe trauma from Glenda, from her experiences. And how did you stay on course and write the truth about her activism? You must have had some moments where you wanted to embellish it, make it softer. How did you stay on the truth?
I think, we interview them every day. Mm-hmm. And I can just think of this one instance. I think the hardest thing to write about was probably about her son, Grant, and learning about how he died. And I remember that day interviewing, and I remember leaving the CASA, that's where they were staying while they were at USD, just taking a walk and letting all of her words sink in and just really giving myself the time and space to absorb all the sadness. I think I was thinking about a lot of things. How can a person hold this for so long? Does sadness ever dissipate? Me as a listener to her story, how do I carry it? Can I just leave the sadness once I'm done with this project? So I think it was it probably would have been easy to ignore it and just say, you know, I'm just writing a story, don't let it affect me. But it did affect me, and I think I just, how I try to stay on track was give myself the time and space to absorb it and let it resonate a little bit, because it was a part of her story and it needed to be in, either implicitly or explicitly.
And briefly, can you just tell us about her, the story of her son, his age, and what happened to him?
Yeah, Grant was a baby that Glenda adopted, and she was waiting for him for a very long time. She was so happy to have him. And he, while she was away doing peace work in Sierra Leone, he was involved in an accident, and he didn't survive the accident. And he was, I think, 2.5.
Mm-hmm.
This, you know, no matter how long ago that was, that's still really fresh for her in some ways, and still as impactful. And I felt that, and everything that we want to say about trauma, like the trite saying of time heals all wounds, on a personal level, I realized that's not always the case.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that she told me about that let me know that she trusted me, and I think that on my end made me want to work harder for her, made me want to dedicate myself even more to the story and just do right by her.
Mm-hmm.
That was really the mantra in my head, right by Glenda.
That's a lovely expression. Possibly the trauma of losing Grant was even more severe in some ways for her than the traumas of her fellow country people. So we've started talking about your writing, mm-hmm. and I think that our listeners would love to hear some of the words that you wrote about Glenda. Would you share some with us?
Yeah, I would love to. What I'm about to share is about Grant's baptism. Glenda walked up to St. John's Chapel at St. George's Cathedral with a 5-month-old baby in her arms. Glenda knew this church well. This was the Archbishop's Church, a site of refuge for so many freedom fighters and anti-apartheid rallies. In the chapel, Archbishop Desmond Tutu was waiting for them. He took the baby from Glenda's arms. He had two very important jobs that day, a baptism and a christening. The baby was cradled in Tutu's right arm over a stone fount. Tutu dipped a ladle into the water and slowly poured it over the baby's forehead. The baby did not cry or fuss. It cooed contently and waved its arms and legs. Glenda was beaming, and the sunlight coming through the chapel's stained glass windows made the room shine with bursting colors. The room could not be filled with any more light or love. "What is the name you have chosen for this child?" Tutu asked Glenda. It didn't take long for Glenda to decide what she would call her son. The baby had been abandoned by his mother and was so unwanted that she hadn't even given him a name. The nurse at the maternity hospital insisted on giving him something that was unsentimental and matter-of-fact. "Just name him Good Enough," said the nurse. But the baby wasn't good enough. He was perfect. Glenda wanted to be reminded of that every day. So on the day that marked the beginning of his new life, the baby was also given a new name. "His name is Grant Sifo Vilskit," Glenda said. It was a fitting name, one that meant gift. "Grant Sifo Vilskit," Tutu said, "I baptize you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit." Tutu kissed Grant on his still wet forehead and handed him over to Glenda. Her loved ones assembled around the fount and each lit a candle for Grant, promising to keep the flame of faith burning in him. Everybody who mattered was there at the church, all of Glenda's family and many of her commissioner colleagues. And then there was Father Michael Lapsley, who lost his hands and part of his sight when a letter bomb addressed to him exploded years earlier. Glenda had asked him to be Grant's godfather. As Lapsley posed for a picture with the baby, tears pooled in the corners of Glenda's eyes. She would keep that photo for a long time. She would know the true significance of her happy baby resting between the hook prosthetics that took the place of Father Lapsley's hands. As Lapsley posed for a picture with the baby, tears pooled in the corners of Glenda's eyes. She would keep that photo for a long time. She would know the true significance of her happy baby resting between the hook prosthetics that took the place of Father Lapsley's hands. She would see the ineffable beauty that emerged from the juxtaposition of woundedness and redemption. Godson and godparent had both been hurt and discarded, and yet here they were, in St. George's Cathedral, proving that there was life after tragedy.
Oh my goodness, that is a very beautiful and moving piece of writing, which I think has affected all of us here with you in the studio right now. You're very good at writing imagery. Did that come from your sports writing, or is this something that Glenda's story drew from you?
I think that, you know, a combination of both, probably. I think that it was, what was challenging about this project was that I wasn't there. So I wanted to pull out every detail. We spent a lot of time talking about details. You know, what color was the shirt? What color was his hat? Did he wear a hat? What kind of shoes did he wear? I asked a lot of seemingly ridiculous questions, but they all helped me in getting some kind of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most important thing to me, was getting across the right emotion. And so when she told me that she felt happy, I would ask her, well, what made you feel happy? What did the room like? Was it lit? Was it a dark room? Were there a lot of colors? So I felt like the interviewing process had two components, one of just the story, getting the story right, and the other was just these small details that I think together make the scene. And so that was my process.
Very beautiful process. Do you think that for Glenda, reading her story through your words and your descriptions changed life for her?
Wow, I hope so. They certainly have for me. I think, you know, I'm writing a memoir myself, and what I have really struggled with or wrestled with is this idea of memory and what is truth when it comes to our memory. And I think that this process, especially seeing how trauma affects memory, really challenged me to see multiple perspectives. And I hope that Glenda gets perhaps a new perspective from that from stories that she told me. She remembers them a certain way, but just see them filtered through a different set of eyes might uncover something else that she didn't notice before. I hope she actually sits down and thinks to herself, wow, I've done a lot. Because I don't know if she's done that. And I hope that this is a reflection of her work, and it's only a small component. It's not even, this is not the biography of Glenda Vilsgut, but just a small component of what she does, and she's still doing this work. So I hope that it shows her how much she's done, how much good she's done, and how much she's affected so many people.
That's a wonderful sentiment. So how can writing be used as a tool towards peace building?
I think writing is a portal to empathy. And through words, people can see a different perspective. You know, Vietnamese was my first language. English was not my first language. And I remember thinking as a young girl that I prefer to express myself in the written word because it gives me time to think about different words and what they really mean. Just really consider what I say. And I feel like the spoken word didn't allow me that. I always felt tongue-tied. I always felt flustered. But there was a comfort in the written word. That's what I personally get from it. But I think that it is a bridge for people to empathize. And I think that's the key to peace building.
In our final minutes of our interview, give us your final thoughts on women and peace building and how we can promote peace in our local and our global communities.
I think before I got into this, I viewed this as a writing project. I didn't think that I would be affected more than that. This is a great professional project to put on my resume. And I was so pleasantly surprised and just knocked off of my feet about the effect that this had on me, realizing how important it is for women to be involved in the peace-building process and the perspectives that women bring to solving a lot of problems around the world. I think what we can do on a local scale, what I've tried to adopt, is mindfulness, understanding of relationships, or trying to understand why there's conflict. Because I think it starts with you and your own personal relationships, and then you carry that in your professional life, and you carry that, you know, beyond just where you live, and you take that with you as you travel. And I think that that really is the beginning of it. How do you deal with conflict in your own life? And that definitely can be applied to bigger conflicts. So I think that that's what it's really taught me, just to be mindful and to analyze conflict and why it's happening, and that will help you get to the answer.
Well, on those wise words, we will conclude this interview with very many thanks to you, Maggie Thatch, for sharing your stories of your writing of a woman peacemaker from South Africa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.